Melissa Mays is traveling the country telling people to make sure the water the government is providing is clean and not filled with cancer-causing toxins. May was the keynote speaker at this weekend's Greening the State House conference in Boone County. She says in Flint, city officials failed to treat the water with chemicals called corrosion inhibitors, which would have prevented aging drinking water pipes from leaching toxins into the water. Some 12,000 children have been exposed to excessive amounts of lead because of that.
Now, what's been done to us has opened the eyes of the rest of the country, and I want people to know that I hope that you don't go through something where officials made the wrong decisions on your water treatment, but it is happening in many different cities across the world.
The Hoosier Environmental Council, which sponsored the event, says Indiana is increasingly becoming aware of its own environmental challenges, including an ongoing lead contamination crisis in East Chicago, a disproportionately large number of coal ash lagoons posing risk to drinking water in low-income urban and rural areas, and not enough oversight from the Indiana Department of Environmental Management. I'm Veronica Carter reporting.
Tuesday's job actions in more than 320 cities nationwide mark the fourth anniversary of the first Fight for 15 strike by fast food workers in New York. According to Yannette Lathrop with the National Employment Law Project, their report shows that the movement has had an impact raising wages for millions across the country.
Since the Fight for 15 started, 19 million workers have benefited from this, and the total raise that workers have received is over $61 billion so far.
Still, 43% of U.S. workers are earning less than $15 an hour. Opponents of raising the minimum wage say it will cause job losses and hurt small businesses. I'm Andrea Sears reporting.
According to research released today by the Environmental Law and Policy Center, with more than 300 solar and wind supply chain businesses, the Buckeye State is primed to become a major renewable energy hub. Senior attorney at the center, Robert Kelter, says the state's established manufacturing base and trained workforce are a big part of the reason.
Ohio has a really strong workforce of people in the manufacturing sector, and those people are perfect for the kinds of jobs that are needed to supply the wind and solar industries.
The report also notes the state's central location and transportation system, as well as the many institutions in Ohio that support the growth and development of renewable energy. Ohio's clean energy standards are slated to resume in 2017, and lawmakers are discussing options for implementation. Those against the measures cite economic concerns, claiming they would be costly for businesses. Mary Sherman reporting.
The Texas Association of Business has released a study pointing out that the backlash from passing a bill forcing people to use the toilet of the gender of their birth certificate could cost the state's businesses up to $8.5 billion and 185,000 jobs. Chuck Smith, CEO of Equality Texas, an LGBT advocacy group, says one business segment is likely to be the hardest hit by protests and boycotts.
There are certain industries that are on the front line of damage, and those would be those that deal with travel and tourism, conventions, sporting events, and entertainment events.
Some state leaders, particularly Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, have put the bathroom bill, which sponsors say protects religious freedoms, at the top of their agenda. But others, such as House Speaker Joe Strauss, say there are more important issues. I'm Mark Richardson.
A study funded by a grant from the U.S. Department of Labor finds support among registered voters across every demographic, with 82% saying they consider paid family leave important or very important. Kristen Rao Finkbeiner, co-founder of Moms Rising, cites an economic advantage for businesses as well.
Businesses are boosted in the studies that have been done in places that have passed this policy, like the state of California, and found that when businesses have paid family leave in place, it actually increases retention, productivity, and lowers recruitment and retraining costs, which is no small matter.
Medical leave, which was also included in this survey, would allow employees to take time off for serious injuries. It would also allow them time off to care for sick or injured family members, including parents, grandparents, children, and siblings.
Congress created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in response to public anger after the last financial meltdown. But Woody Little with the U.S. Public Interest Research Group says lenders are now spending huge amounts backing bills to weaken it. He says the CFPB has become a thorn in the side of banks like Wells Fargo when it catches them cheating consumers.
Many Wells Fargo customers throughout the country, including in West Virginia, are getting money back right now from the CFPB. So there's actually money in their bank accounts that was being leached off by some predatory practices.
Wells Fargo got into trouble for creating about 2 million accounts without customers' knowledge, running up artificial fees. Senator Shelley Moore Capito's husband is a local Wells Fargo executive who hasn't been connected to the scandal. She says she favors reform of the CFPB, which is being criticized as an example of government overreach. Dan Hyman reporting.
Outgoing California Senator Barbara Boxer has been shepherding the bill, until this week when a rider was attached that's raising concerns. The rider by Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein and Republican colleagues allows some Northern California rivers' water to be diverted to Central Valley farmland. Attorney Doug OBG with the National Resources Defense Council says that runs counter to what's needed to save wild salmon populations in those rivers.
Well, these fish are already endangered, and there's a real risk that we'll actually drive them extinct, wiping them off the face of the earth.
The same rider would also make it much easier to construct dams by eliminating congressional oversight in California and at least 16 other states. OBG says that's contrary to current California law. Senator Feinstein has said the rider isn't perfect, but it's the best the bipartisan coalition could do to bring water to San Joaquin Valley farmers.
You are listening to We Are Pittsburgh Talk Radio. Welcome to the latest edition of the Thomas Merton Center Show, a program that highlights the ideas and activities of members of a unique peace and social justice organization in Western Pennsylvania. My name is John Hare, and today we're talking with Merton Center activist Marcia Bandis. Just 2 days ago, Pittsburgh City Council voted to adopt the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, or CEDAW, C-E-D-A-W. Marcia, you were there. You wrote an article. There is an article in the New People, the newsletter of the Thomas Merton Center, about this activity. What's it all about?
Well, thanks, John. We are the Pittsburgh for CEDAW is a project of the Thomas Merton Center, and they've been very supportive. And what this convention is all about is there was a convention on the elimination of all forms of discrimination against women that was passed by the UN back in 1979.
If I could interrupt for a second, a convention means that there was a document drawn together through the United Nations that essentially sets the goals and the policies for the social issue, is that right?
Yes, exactly. And it is the first convention that's ever been done for women, specifically for women's rights. Mm-hmm. And so since that time, 187 countries have signed and ratified that convention. The U.S. is not one of them. Mm-hmm. And we are one of six countries that haven't, and the only industrialized nation that hasn't. So back just a few years ago in 2012, the U.S. decided to start a campaign called Cities for CEDAW. And the goal is to get 100 cities to pass this ordinance that will reflect the principles and establish the framework of CEDAW so that cities can then approach the inequities and the discrimination against women in a methodical way. And so that's what Pittsburgh is doing right now, and it's a project that we've been working on for over a year. And the city council just passed it unanimously on Tuesday.
On Tuesday. Sponsored by Councilwoman Natalia Rudiak. Right?
Yes. She has been an incredible supporter of us right from the get-go. The first time we approached her on this topic, she said she would be glad to support our efforts.
Can you briefly describe some of the main points or principles that are part of CEDAW?
Yes. What we have done here in the United States, well, it covers, actually, there's about 15 principles, of which I won't go into all of them, but because the principles represent women's issues from around the world, so there are some having to do with marriage rights and other access to education and things like that, which don't necessarily apply here in the United States. So what we do is we select the issues from that convention that Pittsburgh can directly affect. And so for us, we chose three. We chose economic development, education, and violence against women. We initially included health care, but that really falls at the county level. So mm-hmm. That'll be a future effort on our part. But right now we're focused on the education, economic development, and violence against women.
And the thrust of this resolution, acceptance of the policy, says that this should be a human right, that these principles should apply throughout the world.
Absolutely. Women's rights are human rights. And we're talking not just equality. We're talking equity. Because if you look at it, women do have needs that are different than men, just like men have needs that are different than women. Women, we hope, will continue to get pregnant and have children. And so you want to have special considerations for that in the workforce. You don't want somebody to have to get fired because they're pregnant or because they're nursing. So we're looking for equity. If a man has to go in for a hernia operation, they don't get fired. So why should a woman get fired because she takes time off from work to have a baby? Mm-hmm. So it's those kinds of things. We're looking for equity. We do want that all across the United States. Today, I believe we are going to be the sixth city to pass an ordinance. San Francisco was the original city. They actually passed it back in 1998. And it was based on their success that we decided to go forward with the Cities for CEDAW campaign. They have seen some remarkable benefits. The biggest one, the one that we like to call out when somebody says, well, why would you want to pass this in Pittsburgh? What benefits could we possibly see? And some of the benefits that they have seen, the biggest one, is they went, after passing this ordinance, and working in coordination with other community organizations, they went 44 months without a domestic violence homicide.
In San Francisco?
In San Francisco, 44 months. And last year alone, we had 8 domestic homicides here in Pittsburgh. Allegheny County has, for 3 years in a row now, had the most domestic homicides of any county in Pennsylvania. So what we're talking about is an area where we could make a significant difference in people's lives if we could even come close to what San Francisco accomplished. I don't know that we can. Pittsburgh is different from San Francisco, but it would certainly be a goal that we would pursue.
So passing the resolution is just the beginning, because there may in some cases be laws on the books about some of this stuff, there may not, but it actually takes a concerted effort. And I'm wondering what else is involved as part of accepting the convention. Is there a commitment to an ongoing examination of the problem and development of ways to address the problems?
Yes, and actually I have to correct you, because this isn't a resolution, this is an ordinance, mm-hmm. which means it'll be law. A resolution doesn't have the teeth that an ordinance has. Mm-hmm. And there are actually, I think at this point, 20 or 30 cities around the country that have passed resolutions as a first step to an ordinance.
I see.
Louisville, Kentucky, Kansas City, Missouri, I believe. St. Louis, Missouri, has passed resolutions. There's a number of resolutions all around the country, and I know that there's a number of cities that are also working on them. But to get back to your question, yes, as part of this ordinance, we had 3 requirements. One was that there be a gender analysis done of the city, and that will, and for that we will need some funding. But they will take a look across the city and see, and I'll call it intersectional gender analysis. And what I mean by that is we're not just going to look at the lives of women. We're going to look at it based on gender, based on race, religion, ethnic background, and immigration status. A lot of different things we'll take a look at to see, what the impact is. Because it's one of these things where those issues are so intertwined. I mean, the question always comes up, if a woman doesn't get a promotion, did she not get the promotion because she's a woman, or because she's black, or because of the religion that she is? So those are the kinds of things. So the first thing would be a gender analysis.
And The ordinance takes effect now?
As soon as the mayor signs it.
As soon as the mayor signs.
Yes.
So does it give women new tools to bring an issue that they feel is discrimination to the city then and to have it attempt to have it resolved?
Actually, there is already a commission in place to do that, and that's the Commission on Human Relations.
Right.
And that exists today, and they can do that today. What our commission will do, and there will be a commission put in place probably starting next year, we'll start populating it, will be to actually to execute, you know, to identify the best process for doing a for doing the gender analysis and then finding who we want to do it. Do we want a university to do it, or do we want to hire an outside company, or how do we want to proceed with that? And so that'll, and then the next issue that they will, that the commission will work on then is working with the city to educate departments on, you know, what is gender equity, and educating them on what we identified or what we learned from the gender analysis.
Okay, hold that thought. We're going to take a break, and when we come back with Marcia Bandis from the CDAW project of the Thomas Merton Center, we're going to talk some more specifically about the goals and the activities that are anticipated for the new commission. I'm John Heer. This is the Thomas Merton Center show on We Are Pittsburgh.
From 1776 forward, Americans have opposed having soldiers do police work on our soil. But in recent years, Pentagon chiefs have teamed up with police chiefs to circumvent that prohibition. How? Simply by militarizing police departments. Through the little-known military transfer program, the Pentagon has been shipping massive amounts of surplus war equipment to our local gendarmes. This reflects a fundamental rewiring of the mindset now guiding neighborhood policing. Police chiefs today commonly send out squads brandishing heavy arms and garbed in riot gear for peaceful situations. Recruiting videos now feature clips of SWAT team officers dressed in black, hurling flash grenades into a home, then storming the house, firing automatic weapons. Who wants anyone recruited by that video working their neighborhood? As a city councilman in rural Wisconsin commented when told his police were getting a 9-foot-tall armored vehicle, somebody has to be the first to say, "Why are we doing this?" The New York Times reports that the town's police chief responded that there's always a possibility of violence. Really? Who threatens us with such mayhem that every burg needs a war zone armory and a commando mentality? Astonishingly, a sheriff's spokesman in suburban Indianapolis offered this answer: veterans. The sheriff's department needed a mine-resistant armored vehicle, he explained, to defend itself against U.S. veterans returning from the Afghanistan war. War veterans, he said, have the ability and knowledge to build homemade bombs and to defeat law enforcement techniques. This is Jim Hightower saying that is lame, loopy, insulting, shameful, and just plain stupid. Maybe he just forgot to pack his brain when he left for work that day, but I'm afraid it's a window into the altered mindset of police chiefs and trainers.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
It's me, your heart. High blood pressure is serious, and if you think I'm just going to keep ticking away, you're wrong. I can quit whenever I want, but I like my job. Just treat me better. Maybe we can do some exercise on occasion? After all, we're in this together.
Don't let your heart quit on you. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get yours to a healthy range before it's too late. Find out how at heart.org/bloodpressure. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
If you own a gun, you have a full-time responsibility. When you aren't using it, be sure it can't get into the hands of curious children, troubled teenagers, a thief, or anyone else who might misuse it. Your family, friends, and neighbors are all counting on you. Remember, always lock it up. For more information on firearm storage safety, visit ncpc.org. This message brought to you by the National Crime Prevention Council, the Bureau of Justice Assistance, and the Ad Council.
Hey, what's up, everybody? I'm Jason Derulo, and I love the fact that music connects to people all over the country. But unfortunately, so does something else: childhood hunger. 15 million children struggle with hunger in America. However, the Feeding America nationwide network of food banks is able to help provide over 3 billion meals to children and families in need all across the country. Join me in the fight against hunger at feedingamerica.org. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're Feeding America. A message from Feeding America and the Ad Council.
You're listening to We Are Pittsburgh Talk Radio, and this is the Thomas Merton Center Show. I'm John Hare. Our guest is activist Marcia Bandis. Marcia, what kind of issues will the new policies on discrimination against women look at, and how is the commission going to function?
Well, there's going to be three areas that we're going to be looking at, economic development, education, and then violence against women. And so the gender analysis will do some of that. We already know the reason we chose those three areas was because we know that there are challenges with those. For example, when it comes to economic development, we know that 77% of heads of households headed by women live in poverty.
So 77%.
Yes.
And this is in Pittsburgh. Allegheny and Pittsburgh.
This is Pittsburgh. This is Pittsburgh, yes. So, and 68% of these are headed by black women. So it's really highlighting the need to, when we do our gender analysis, to look at it, what they refer to as intersectionally, which, so to look at not just the fact that they're women, but also we need to look at race and ethnicity and other aspects of it. The other thing would be, for example, that in this general Pittsburgh area, a third of the businesses are owned by women, but generate only 3.5% of total receipts and 6.8% of employees. So you have to say, well, is that the way the women want it? Is that, you know, what's best, you know, what they have found is best for their business? Or is it because they haven't been able to get additional funding or loans to expand their business? It's just a question. It's not, we don't have the answers to that at this point in time. To get back also to economic development and to women who live in poverty, I think the other thing that we should point out is that even if the women want to find work, and many of them actually do work, and it's very difficult to get to work, what some of the analysis has shown is that they don't live, they're like in pockets, and so they lots of times they're not as near to transportation as would make it easy to get to work. There, it's limited childcare available. People living in poverty can get vouchers for childcare, but the childcare that's available to them, that they can use those vouchers on, has to be certified at what they refer to as three or four stars. And there's only 21 of those in the Pittsburgh area. So there's nowhere, they're not all even near where these women live. Uh-huh. And so there's a very limited amount of access to decent child care. And I guess the only other comment that I'd make in terms of that would be in education. There's two areas there that we could look, I mean, there's a lot of areas that we could look at, but the two areas that come to mind are girls in sports. In the Pittsburgh public schools, girls have about half the opportunity to participate in sports as boys do. And it's been shown that that when people participate in sports, it increases their engagement in school, it increases their leadership and self-esteem, and it also gives them a leg up when going to college because they remain engaged in high school. So those are a couple of different things. And then, of course, the violence against women. I think these statistics have been public before, but the Women's Center in Shelter had, I think in 2015, had 6,000 women seeking help during that time, of which 57% of those came from Pittsburgh. So we know that there is domestic violence issues there. And Allegheny County issues over 4,000 protection from abuse orders annually in Allegheny County. So once again, there's areas that we know that we can look at that hopefully our gender analysis will be able to help us point out.
And briefly, you had mentioned San Francisco's exemplary record there with respect to violence issues. Were there some things that they did that you think are worthy of looking at here? Or?
Yes, there are. But once again, I don't want to, I have to be careful here because I really want the gender analysis to speak to what's needed. And I want the departments, as they look at it, for them to come up with their own action plans, because it's something that they've got to implement. And so for me to stand back here and say, well, this should be done or that should be done, really, they know what their capabilities are, they know what their budgets are, they know what their programs are.
You're referring to the city departments that will be carrying out the analysis?
That will be doing I'll call it the second phase of the analysis, where they look at their own budgets and programs and see what they can do to contribute to reducing the inequity in the city.
What's the legislation say about who will be on the commission and their responsibilities to work and speak with the women that would be the involved in the analysis?
There's the commission will be made up of a mix of employees from the city government, people from the community, especially those that have got experience in these areas, of whether, you know, economic development, it might be somebody from a business organization, or it could be from an immigration organization. It could be any, but people who are familiar with the needs of the community will participate in it, as well as I'm sure there will be what I'll refer to as academics who are very familiar with gender analysis and doing surveys and analysis and things like that. So it'll be a mix. And that mix may change over time, since our initial focus is going to be on gender analysis and our evolving emphasis is going to be on action plans and the implementation of those action plans.
And are they nominated by council people to the commission, or are they recommended by organizations, or how?
It's going to be a mix. They will be appointed by the mayor, but they will be recommended. We can recommend them. The council can recommend them. So I'm sure it's going to be a cooperative effort to identify the commission. And then there will be an executive director that will be appointed by the mayor. And that'll be the only paid position. The others will be volunteer positions.
That was my next question about the funding.
The funding will be for the executive director, and it will also be for the gender analysis. So those are the two areas.
And in the ordinance, the funding is acknowledged. Is there a particular revenue source for the funding?
We've requested the funding in the ordinance at this point in time, because of where we are in the year. Councilwoman Natalia Rudiak is going for an amendment to the budget to get us funding for next year.
For next year.
And we believe that it sounds to us like it's well supported by the council, so we expect it to pass.
With a unanimous vote, that's a good step.
Yes, absolutely.
Marcia, in our last minute or so, perhaps you could just speak about your hopes for the commission and what you'd like to see in another year or two happening.
Thank you. Because actually, I am so excited, because I just feel like we've gone into a second phase. All of our efforts have been focused right now on getting the ordinance passed. And we do have, you know, roughly 30 organizations that have endorsed us, which helped us get through this. But this following year, we want to focus on extending our reach out to many more organizations to get input from them as to what they see their needs of their communities, in addition to the gender analysis. But this next year is really going to be focused on building the commission and then on starting to go after the gender analysis. So it's going to be about a year and a half before we really start working on action plans and getting things done. But I believe that because of the methodical approach that we're taking, that in the long run we'll be able to make a significant difference to the lives of women and girls in Pittsburgh.
And there will be This is just not an academic endeavor. It's an endeavor that will involve all the women that are affected by the...
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Marcia. Appreciate having you on the program. You've been listening to the Thomas Merton Center Show on We Are Pittsburgh Talk Radio. Become a member of the center. Subscribe to our monthly publication, The New People. Go to www.thomasmertoncenter.org or call us at 412-361-3022. I'm John Hare. Thanks for listening.